Secretary, please call the roll.
Senator Rooney.
Present.
Senator Faith. Senator Halpern.
Here.
Senator Kelly.
Here.
Senator Ziegler.
Here.
I would like to bring before the committee House Bill 157, the Revisers Bill. This bill was before us previously. I did indicate to the committee that I wanted every member of the committee to take a look at the bill. Revisers bills have on occasion been controversial. I wanted every member to have the opportunity to review the bill in its entirety to ensure that they had no concerns about any of the provisions. Mr. Deardorff, the reviser, did testify before the committee. If there are any questions that any member wishes to raise, they should be raised at this time. And any questions that we might have should be directed to the reviser. Senator Fakes, we've just taken up House Bill 157. The Secretary, please note that Senator Fakes is present. There are no questions on the bill. It would be appropriate at this time to move the bill forward so that it might go to its next committee referral.
I would move, Mr. Chairman, that we pass HB 157 individual recommendations.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, House Bill 157 is passed from committee with individual recommendations. Thank you, Mr. Reviser. Next, I would like to bring up Senate Bill 83. An act relating to the limited entry and providing for an effective date. I'd like to call at this time Bruce Quanley from the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission.
Mr. Chairman, what's your pleasure with respect to this bill? Would you like me to take you through it?
Bruce, if you could state your name for the record.
Surely. I'm Bruce Quanley. I'm the chairman of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. With me on this matter is Margo Canute, who's here from the Department of Law, who's helped us.
Margo, please join us.
For the most part, Senate Bill 83 is a bill which was before the Senate last year. It was one that passed through a number of committees and was ready to go on the Senate floor at the point that the House adjourned. There are two exceptions. There are two sections of the bill which have been added. In the meantime, Sections 2 and Section 7. And I can take you through this item by item if you wish.
Please do.
Section number 1 is a provision in response to a case called the Gilliland case, a Superior Court decision. The legislature, from the beginning of limited entry, has had a prohibition on the leasing of limited entry permits, the lending of entry permits for profit. The Gilliland case in Superior Court found an apparent loophole in that prohibition. And this provision is intended to plug that loophole. The loophole was a situation where an individual transferred a permit and then required it to be transferred to a third party at the end of the transaction. Section 2 is a new section, and it is intended to make clear that the protections which apply to entry permits survive the death of the holder, so that the same protections benefit family members who would be entitled to a permit. It was a belief of, I think, everybody that this was what the legislature intended with the adoption of the act back in 1973. And it was originally the holding of the Supreme Court that was the case in a case called Timberley v. Jeffries. However, in that opinion, one of the justices, it was a 3-2 decision, one of the justices had to disqualify himself, leaving the Supreme Court in a state of tie. And so that opinion was destroyed, and the Superior Court opinion was reinstated. And the Superior Court opinion held to the contrary, that these protections that apply to entry permits are lost upon the death of a holder. So we would hope by this section that the legislature would make it clear that in an estate, the protections applying to permits do survive. Section 3 of the bill is essentially a cleanup provision. It removes a reference to a federal agency, which no longer exists. It does maintain our responsibility to look at federal poverty guidelines and determining who's eligible for poverty fees before the agency. Section Section 4 of the bill.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, just one second. Senator Kelly has a question.
Resources Committee recommendation. We have the first recommendation. I'd like to know how the Resources Committee recommended on the bill.
Yes, that will be done. Continue, Mr. Conley.
Thank you. Section 4 of the bill would authorize the commission to charge interest on arrearages fees owing to the commission. It comes up primarily in a situation where an individual who's been out of state has been falsely claiming residence to the state, and when that's discovered and the commission seeks to collect those arrearages, there would be an opportunity to collect interest as long as the arrearages remain unpaid. Section 5 of the bill is intended to give the commission some discretion in determining what particular measures are employed when it comes to measuring economic dependence on a fishery and past participation in the fishery. This goes back to the initial decision as to how to rank applicants for entry into a given fishery. I would call your attention to the fact that the Senate Resources Committee provided a detailed statement of legislative intent pertaining to Section 5. Section 6 is essentially a cleanup provision, just streamline some of the one of our day-to-day processes when it comes to issuing educational permits. Section 7 is a new section which was added to the bill at the request of Senator Jaroff in Resources Committee. His intent was to the extent practicable, to ensure that the commission conduct hearings in connection with the limitation of the fishery near to and at the same time as a pertinent Board of Fish meeting, so that the same individuals who were attending a meeting of the Board of Fisheries would have a convenient opportunity to attend an entry commission meeting. Section 8 of the bill pertains to a statute which has been in effect since 1979 and has authorized the commission to institute administrative proceedings to revoke permits, essentially when people have lied to the commission to get benefits, when people have intentionally misrepresented facts to the commission. The authority that the commission has had since 1979 is to revoke permits held by such individuals. What this section would do in some ways is less than that. It would make clear that the commission has authority to do less than outright revoke and take a permit. It would authorize the commission and make clear the commission's authority to suspend a permit up to 3 years and to administer a fine of not more than $5,000, something in the way of a lesser included offense and a way to try to tailor remedies in these proceedings to the particular offense before us. It would also authorize the commission to do more than the original statute. It would authorize the commission to go to address the permits as opposed to the singular permit at issue, but the permits held by an individual who abuses the system and submits false information to the state. It would also authorize the commission to bring proceedings against third parties who are involved in these transactions. More and more transactions before the commission are put together by brokers, and it is entirely possible that at some point a broker may be involved in a fraudulent transaction before the commission, and the statute would authorize the commission to bring an administrative proceeding against such a person, and the fine would be available as a remedy in that event. Until we get to the final subsection, the remainder of Section 8 is essentially cleanup, but it changes in wording. It's not until you get down to subsection G on page 5, line 24, that there's a substantive proceeding and a substantive section. And that section codifies what was the Superior Court's holding in the Jarstad case, mainly that the legislature, in enacting this legislation, intended it to apply to those people who secured permits by fraud from the beginning of the act, going back to 1973 when all this began. This would make that clear, and I should mention that the Superior Court was abundantly clear on the issue, but the issue is now on appeal to the Supreme Court. But this would make legislative intent clear that those were the individuals intended to be addressed by this section. Section 9 of the bill is essentially cleanup. The basic provision of the part of the Act since 1979, and this would basically clean up the wording of that section. It doesn't change the nature of the penalties for this particular criminal violation. Section 10 is essentially a cleanup provision. We have always provided in our regulations that the information described in the section would be withheld from public disclosure. It was pointed out to us by the Department of Law that it would be helpful if we had statutory authority to make that clear. So we're simply seeking the statutory authority to shore up our regulations, which will protect this information from public scrutiny. And I believe that's it.
Again, which two sections were added in the resources?
Section 2. Section 2 was a new section that was added since the bill was introduced to the legislature last session. And that came from the AG's office. And we deliberated together, but that's in response to a particular case. But that was not before the legislature last session. The section that was added in resources was Section 7.
Senator Kelly.
Is the permit now exempt from claims of creditors?
That's the case.
Senator Bates.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Through the chair, I am really disturbed by Section 2. I was wondering if we can ask the Assistant Attorney General if there's any other property that enjoys this type of elevated immune status in law.
Care to respond?
Yes. My name is Margot Canute from the Department of Law. There is a list of property that is exempt from creditors in our statutes. The limited entry permit does not stand alone in being given special protection, but it is more removed in the sense that it does not immediately jump out as one as a necessity of life. At any rate, the legislative determination was initially made when the Limited Entry Act was first promulgated that it should have this status, and it has been that way since the beginning. It is exempt from bankruptcy claims. It is unavailable for any claims except the state's claims if the state has loaned money towards the purchase of the permit. We've not been called upon to give special scrutiny to the status since it's been on the books, 10 years now.
Senator Pace.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't care how long it's been there. I'm just interested in what the intent was and why the limited entry permit would have this kind of status.
Senator Kelly?
I have the same concern. I can see where the state should have first go at it, but after that, I can't see where it should be.
Mr. Conley?
If I may, Mr. Chair. The limited entry permit is something less than property. Part of it is as a management tool for the state. In addition, because of the system that has been constructed, it's the means of making a living for individuals who are in the fisheries, and the only means. It's the only access to the fishery. I think the notion was that individuals in that access ought to be protected, and that their right to fish and not to be controlled by creditors, for instance, canneries and some of the corporate interests, which have had a great deal of influence on fishing, that limited entry permit holders ought to be protected from that kind of influence. What I would point out is that as long as a permit holder chooses to fish and employ the permit for fishing, it is protected. If a permit holder seeks to treat it as an asset and sell it as a piece of property, nothing about the proceeds from that permit would be protected from creditors. It's only to the extent that an individual is securing the means to his or her livelihood that the individual enjoys those protections.
I still don't understand why we should protect fishermen and we don't protect doctors or architects or anybody else. I'm not being bought.
Alcohol licenses?
Yeah, right. Restaurateurs. I mean, I think of an architect whose business is his livelihood and he dies or something. There are creditors there. I mean, people still have to pay. I hate to think we're setting up a special group of people who do not have to pay their debts.
Studies that they've done with the business. Some of the concerns were transfer permits from rural areas into non-rural areas, transfer permits.
may be the time to repeal that thing, but it's a fairly major question with all the fish people. There's less objection to repealing it than I thought there would be.
It's actually, and the section that we have here extends to the survivors and doesn't really deal with the question that we've been discussing, but it's appropriate to...
Section 1 repeats the notations. It can't be pledged, more be released or encumbered in any way. It can't be transferred, and it can't be taken by repossession or foreclosure or any condition requiring subsequent transfer. And beefing up a section that may not be appropriate any longer, but I think you need to talk to the... to the fishermen to see what they think about.
Great. Margo and then could you move closer to the microphone?
Yes.
I'm having difficulty picking you up your recording device.
The proposed amendment to this section is meant to fill a gap that exists in the current statute. And I know your questions go to why do we have that protection at all. But unless one were going to do away with the protection entirely, it makes sense to add claims of creditors and the estate to fill out the circle, because the current situation is the object is if the whole family basically has been fishing the permit and it's been in the husband's name and he dies, if there's a surviving spouse, she takes the permit by survivorship and it's not eligible for creditors, for attachment by creditors under the current provision. The situation where there's no surviving spouse, but there are children who want to fish the permit. Under the current law, in that situation, it goes through the estate and it is subject to creditors' claims just because there was no surviving spouse. If there is more than one child, then either the permit has to go to the one individual who's going to be fishing it, or if they're going to sell it, at that point it is subject to the claims of creditors. The only point is that if somebody is going to fish it, it can be saved for that entire family that was dependent on commercial fishing.
Senator
Fakes. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't pretend to know anything about this at all, and so please don't anybody think I do. And this is the first I've encountered this, but I just think I have trouble with the state of Alaska encouraging people not to pay their debts. I just do, as a matter of philosophy. So if my problem is, yes, I need to go back and repeal the whole section, then yes, but as a matter of philosophy, I have problems with us encouraging people to incur debts, and they have a valuable asset, and it can't be used to pay off that obligation, and that really bothers me. It's a matter of principle.
Senator Helper gave some background to it. If Senator Tillion were here, he could probably give even more expansive background to it. The statute that the Assistant Attorney General referred to is the exemption statute, which does exempt as a matter of law and has, since Alaska was a territory, certain items from debt. We removed the toolbox and horse and oxen from it, but it's a slightly modernized version of those things, so that people are not put out in the street, and the state then is required for public order to provide some means of sustenance for them. And there are several things beyond the home and trade fixtures that are exempt, and this happens to be one of them. We're off the top of my head, I can't think of other things that are exempt that are in this category. It's unique. Do you recall, for exemption purposes, other than home and trade items, what else besides moving and trade permits are exempt?
No, I do not.
Sure, do I? Auction, books.
Those are home, would be household or trade items. But I'm trying to think of something that is in a unique category like this that is also exempt.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to argue against myself because I don't think this is there, but this very definitely is a trade item. This is the license to engage in your trade. I don't think they should have the values they have or a number of other things, but it very definitely is a trade item. And it certainly is important as the tools to be a mechanic if you're a mechanic.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and as a feature of that, I think it was important to the legislature at the beginning to make sure that permits remained in the hands of people who would in fact fish them. The legislature was explicit that it wanted to discourage speculation, creating markets and permits just as property. They are. Senator Albert says a means to making a living and avoiding having them as security and having them accessible to creditors does serve that purpose.
Senator Albert.
Do you think that purpose is still thought of in the same way that it was when the act was passed?
My impression is that among the people that I've dealt with in the industry, yes, questions have been raised about what will happen if state loan programs are reduced or eliminated, and what will the future look like. But for the time being, my impression is that the general feelings underlying that provision have not changed.
Because these provisions are what requires a state loan program, basically.
I have strong reservations about attaching value to what is essentially a state license. I have it with regard to liquor licenses. I have it with regard to visa. It reminds me of the British imperial policy with the East India Company. I think it's inappropriate for today to create state monopolies that have value and can be transferred.
Can I
hear you? The only part.
Can I hear you?
The only thing they don't have, the East India Company has a private army. I think it's repugnant to the concept of a free enterprise economy. That's my personal opinion.
I would agree with you. And of course, the situation we have is when we're 14 years down the road into a program like this, I do believe it would probably take some time to study the situation and trying to decide what viable alternative there are.
I don't suggest today that we repeal limited entry today, but I think because it is a complex situation of managing fisheries, but the value question is one in the shorter run that we could deal with, even though we are much like the Uncle Venus tale, we are, I'm afraid, partly into a very difficult to get out. We have to tar it. Yes?
Two things I would just like to mention in response to your statement, Mr. Chairman. The distinguishing this system from various empire aspects of empire, I would suggest that what is different about limited entry is the resource to which it pertains. The fact that we are dealing with something over which no one, at least of all the state, has very effective control, and the state simply finds it necessary to institute this system in order to effectively manage the resource. The other element, something that grew out of that process, was the transferability of permits. And I guess I would commend the committee's attention on that subject, the Ostrowski case, which came down from the state Supreme Court and ultimately was held in place by the Supreme Court, but it engages in considerable discussion of the transferability of permits and from the standpoint of the state and why that provision was important to the state in the scheme.
I appreciate your comments with regard to managing the resource. And I think there's you can make a good case for the present system of limiting entry as opposed to trying to control more fleet, perhaps the possibility of last night. I won't quarrel with that now, that it is the transferability, the value question that I think makes it subject to abuse and removes it from state regulation to a degree and imparts more a concession. Again, a concession not unlike the British East India Company or enjoyed order, the fact that they are granted by the Arab Emirates now. Senator Hopper.
Mr. Chairman, I got over the first couple of sections of this bill resources. The one that I had the problem with was Section 5, where we're really dealing directly with a Supreme Court case that referred to somewhat indirectly in the subsistence question, but the statute required four criteria. The commission used kind of a combined criteria that didn't count them all. And the Supreme Court said that if there's four criteria, you consider them all. And we're changing this now. There's a number of court cases that are currently going on. I think we need some amplification of what's happening. It seems like an awful lot of this bill is directly dealing with court cases that are pending or that may come out of previous court cases. And it's remedial legislation. And sometimes I have a problem with doing it wrong and then changing the statute to make wrong right. After the Supreme Court, somebody finally goes all the way through the process, and hey, I was right. And so it's back to the legislature. Well, now we'll change it to the way we wanted it in the first place, the way we've been interpreting it all along. And the argument to us is return to the status quo. Well, the legislature, when they passed this, had four criteria. They must have had some reason for that. I think you need some amplification of that whole area.
A response?
If I may, one individual did go all the way to the Supreme Court, challenged what the commission did in the hand troll fishery. The case was the Rudder case, and we are responding to that case by implementing the relief which the court call for. Nothing about this section. And this is something, this is set out in the letter of intent, which came from resources I would refer you to. But we're in the process of implementing the relief in the letter. What that decision came down to, in looking at various fisheries, the commission had looked at the language here in the original statute, which called for a reasonable balance of the following hardship standards. And basically, they are two. They are economic dependence and past participation in the fishery. And then it went on to say, including but not limited to, in the case of economic dependence, income derived, percentage of income derived from the fishery, reliance on alternative occupations, availability of alternative occupations, investment, and so forth. Similarly, as to past participation, it called for looking at the number of years of participation as well as the consistency of participation. The problem that the commission has run into is that in some fisheries, because of the way the fisheries are, in fact, certain measures don't make sense. And the example I would give is in the herring fisheries, all of them. From the records before the commission, herring fisheries have been characterized largely as a crapshoot. They are sometimes over before they begin. Individuals go out and go all through the effort of fishermen right beside them to take nothing away. So that it was difficult for the commission to speak in terms of reliance on this particular fishery and percentage reliance, because few people could claim to rely on something that some people liken to the banana ice bollies. Similarly, these are fisheries that are managed necessarily so that sometimes they begin and are over in the space of an hour. So it similarly made no sense to talk in terms of consistency of participation in a given year as how many weeks or how many minutes over another fisherman, one fisherman participated. They were measurements that weren't meaningful in a given fishery. So what the commission asked its lawyers was, does reasonable balance include the discretion to weight some of these things at zero if they don't count? And the lawyers at the time said, well, certainly. And the next question was, well, if something could be weighted at zero, do we have discretion not to include it in the point scheme? And the answer from the lawyers and the answer from the Superior Court here through Judge Stewart initially in the Rudder case was, well, yes, of course. That's clearly what the legislature intended. Well, when the issue reached the Supreme Court in Rudder, the Supreme Court said, no, you have to read the statute literally, and you have to use each and every one of these measurements because that's what the statute says. Subsequent to the Rudder case, the Supreme Court acknowledged in the Kamelkopf case that what the commission had done in Rudder may well have been consistent with the overall purposes of the Act, which was actually distinguishing one fisherman from another on a scale of hardship. But the problem was it didn't comply with the literal terms of the statute. Well, Rudder was the only case in court that raises this issue, and is the only case in court that has raised this issue. We're implementing that relief, but there are some 12 other fisheries throughout the state, and something on the order of 2,600 permit holders with stakes in those fisheries who depend upon them. And they are the herring fisheries, and they are the AYK fisheries, where as indicated in the letter of intent from resources, what the commission did was reasonable respect to those given fisheries. The commission simply didn't use measuring tools that didn't make sense in a given fishery, but nonetheless, the commission would run afoul of a claim that it didn't literally comply with the statute. So what the commission is asking by this section is simply is some discretion, and the qualifier that's here is when reasonable for the fishery, some discretion in picking which tools to use and being in a position to pick only those tools that make sense.
Senator Hubbard?
I think something that should come into this, you use the herring fishery as an example of a crapshoot. It wasn't a commission decision after the institution of limit entry to go into the herring fishery and, in fact, limit entry in that area?
It was a commission decision to limit entry in the herring fisheries, yes.
Okay. Then the whole point is that the limited entry system is not a static system. It's not that we got into fisheries and limited entry and created values and have a past problem that's not going forward. This is a continuously building process, fishery by fishery by fishery. And the description of the herring fishery as a crapshoot is probably the best argument why it never should have been limited. It wasn't something that met the criteria, logically, of economic dependence.
I would point out that there are two criteria, and one is promoting management of the resources. resource, and the other is promoting the economic stability of the resource. And if anyone was adamant about the need to limit entry into the herring fisheries, it was the managers of Fish and Game who were faced with this impossible task of a fishery that, in some instances, could not even open because the number of units of gear was too great. They couldn't risk an opening for fear of destroying the resource. It was, in some respects, like salmon fisheries in the early 70s, although you had, the problem was even compounded by the fact that you had sometimes incredibly short seasons. So that, on that hand, managers, biological managers, were begging for limitation so the fishery could be properly managed. On the other hand, limitation does lend some stability to the fishery, which is what the statute calls for. It means you can identify the number of participants, and those participants have something that they can count on, to the extent that you can count on a herring fishery, but it does make a difference in that respect.
Albert, well, what the statute called for was a consideration of criteria that didn't make sense when applied to the herring fishery. And that's why the court ruled the way they did.
Mr. Chair, I would differ with that, because what the statute calls for is that when the purposes of the statute would be served, and they are two, it's promotion of conservation and sustained yield management, and promotion of economic stability in a given fishery, we have, by the terms of the statute, a duty limit, and the term is shall in that event.
Sir, I forgot. The whole thing is continuously building itself bigger and bigger and further and further. And as we've sat here through the time that we've been here, even if we weren't here at the institution, the limited entry questions have gone forward all the time. And they continue to go forward right now. You're making decisions on limit new fisheries right now.
There are, Mr. Chairman, few fisheries in the state left to limit at this point. But we have a call upon to look at some of the unlimited fisheries, and we did make a decision with respect to Southeast Crab during the last year.
No wish to take any more committee time, Senator Bates.
Mr. Chairman, was this declared unconstitutional? Somewhere in my foggy brain, it seems to me that limited entry was declared. What happened?
No, Mr. Chairman. In fact, the system, every time one of the basic questions has been before the court, the system itself has been upheld. And the Supreme Court has done a tremendous job of narrowing the issues that can now be brought in claims against the system. I would suggest that the system imbalance has been shorn up by the courts more than the courts have. In fact, when it came to any fundamental principles, the system has been upheld. The courts have done consistently what the Supreme Court has characterized as fine-tuning, and there are a number of individual cases that have come back before us. But whenever the important foundations of the system have been before the court, like transferability in the Ostrowski case, it has been upheld.
If I could clarify that, I believe what you're recalling is the very first decision that was issued in the Ostrowski case was by Superior Court Judge Victor Carlson, and he did hold that limited entry was unconstitutional. He is a renegade judge, and he has had a fairly unsuccessful record with the Alaska Supreme Court. He has quite a reversal rate. This added fuel to that track record. He was reversed 5-0 by the Alaska Supreme Court. 8 out of 9 of the U.S. Supreme Court justices said, no big issue here. What the Alaska Supreme Court did was fine. So there is something you're recalling, but it's in the past, and it was overruled resoundingly.
Does he know you consider a renegade judge?
If there's no further comment, I'd like to hold this bell until next week. Thank you very much, Colin, for coming.
Sure.
Next, I would like to take up Senate Bill 84. I'm going to motor vehicle laws. I'd like to call Bill Brown from the Division of Motor Vehicles and Lisa Nelson from the Department of Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Brown, Division of Motor Vehicles and Department of Public Safety. You basically want us to go through this item by hand. It's a housekeeping measure.
Yes, sir.
Most of it is to clarify sections. As far as section one, it, Basically, what it does is give the authority to law enforcement officers to impound a vehicle if the identification number on that vehicle has been altered or defaced or removed in any way. Basically, there's no legal reason that that should ever happen. It's generally a sign that the vehicle has been stolen, and this gives the authority of the officer to impound it. An important item about this, the way this is drafted, the owner of the vehicle would not have to pay the impound cost. The agency that impounds it would have to pay it. And the reason for that is basically looking again that it's a vehicle that's been stolen, and will probably go back to somebody who was driving it at the time it was impounded.
Can I ask a question? The police agency is maybe involved with pay the impound costs?
Yes, that is correct.
That's a policy decision. I guess the question is whether in the case of a stolen vehicle, the state should pay the cost rather than the person from whom it was stolen.
Mr. Chairman, basically this time, of course, if the vehicle's going on the road and it's unsafe for the equipment malfunction or something, and it's impounded, the owner has to pay that.
Could you elaborate on that again?
Okay. Basically, at this time, on the other type of impound, if the vehicle's unsafe to be on the roadway and the officer impounds it, of course, then the owner is the one that's responsible for that, and therefore the owner does have to pay that.
But is it the responsibility of all the taxpayers in the state to pay for the impound and towing of a stolen vehicle, or is that just another cost that someone should have to bear that owns that vehicle? Nobody's sympathetic with the problem of stolen vehicles. So sure. It's a question of who should bear the cost. It should be all the taxpayers, or whether it should be the owner of that specific property. Is there anything on behalf of the committee? Am I seeing an issue?
No, I see
great consequence.
I see the issue.
Senator Halpern?
I've got a question. It's not a change, but it's in the law. What is the definition of on a highway? It's very simple. The vehicular way is probably not quite so simple. But what is a motor vehicle which is driven on a highway or a vehicular way or area? What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, basically that's defined in 2835-260, if you would like me to
read
it.
Yeah, please.
A vehicular way or area means a way, path, or area other than a highway or private property, which is designated by official traffic control devices or customary usage, and which is open to the public for purposes of pedestrian or vehicular travel, and which way or area may be restricted in use to pedestrians, bicycles, or other specific types of vehicles, as determined by the department or other agency having jurisdiction over the way, path, or area. Fairly broad.
Now, I'm just wondering about rural areas where you're talking about a section line easement that's been cleared out and it's used by local traffic, be it off-road vehicles or whatever. It seems that there's kind of a definitional problem in there. I know that there's a problem in some of the rural communities with driving three-wheelers and four-wheelers. They're illegal, and it's just not enforced. They drive all over the place. But I wonder if the department might look at that to see what they do about that, because I think it's something that is going to come up at some point.
I'm sure we could ask the department a lot to look at, what that definition should be, if it should be changed, and address that.
Some future. Great. Thank you. Please continue.
As far as Section 2, that basically gives the department or the hearing officer at the time of the hearing the right to revoke or suspend registration or title. It's strictly a housekeeping measure. There's specific sections of this Title 28 that says when it can be suspended or revoked. One section speaks to registration, one section speaks to title. The hearing officer is not always a departmental member, and so strictly to clarify the point, the hearing officer could, if they sustain the department's action, revoke or suspend a registration or title.
Section 3 of the bill amends Title 28, which deals with a motorist's right to appeal from an administrative hearing officer's decision. The new language would allow the motorist to appeal a hearing officer's decision to the district court and specifies the scope of appellate review. Under existing law, a person can get a hearing de novo in the district court, which means that they can get a complete new hearing on the same issues which are already decided at the administrative hearing. And this kind of causes, it sort of makes the administrative process superfluous in that you have the same people testifying over again in the district court. And essentially not a good use of administrative and judicial resources. So what this amendment does is say that the administrative hearing decision will go up on appeal to the district court, and the district court will make a decision based on the record and not on a complete new hearing where you bring in all the new witnesses and go through the whole song and dance again. There is a problem with this language, however. Notice that it says it goes to the district court. Well, right now, the Superior Court is the court that has the ability to hear administrative appeals, so, and not the district court. So if you were going to change it to district court, you would have to change the jurisdictional statutes under Title 22, as well as change the court rules. So our choice on this particular section here would be to make all references to Superior Court and make the administrative appeals go to Superior Court like they do regularly, or go back to the old way, and we wouldn't have any problems with that. Just go back to the old de novo way, even though it is kind of a waste of time and resources. The reason I say we could go back to the old ways, I understand that the court system has problems with this type of system. If we go directly from the administrative hearing to the Superior Court, I don't know what their problems are, but they could come up later on. It's kind of a policy decision, and I'm not sure if you want to wait on this bill to find out more about it, or if you want to...
I do plan to wait and hear the... in the court system. On that, I prefer the system of going to district court without a trial de novo, and it shouldn't be in Superior Court, and that's consistent with the court system's position on the issue also, but I think it's very important that we hear their side of it before making any final decision. Senator Halpert?
Well, I'm confused. This is a government bill. It's been through one committee,
and now the administration's position is changing apparently.
Well, it was an oversight.
what's meant is if somebody, if a registration title is fraudulently procured, and all this does is add that word in there, basically. Section 5 of the bill, we would recommend at this time that it be deleted from the bill. And the reason for that is this item is addressed in the revisor's bill, which already went through this committee this morning. It wasn't noticed before that it was in both bills. So Section 5 should be deleted. Section 6 is strictly technical change to correct an ambiguity in the present law in regards to senior citizens or residents 65 years or older being exempt from both registration tax and from the registration fee. This clarifies the point that they are exempt from both. Of course, the registration tax is the tax we do collect for some municipalities at the time that they register a vehicle.
We have an additional problem in that area. You probably know some people exempt and then receive money for it. Other people don't exempt senior citizens and still receive money for it. There's an additional problem in that area. In fact, I have an idea for some. Let me check with this bill we lay on the table. Just for the committee's benefit, I may propose some language in that regard. We'll not change what you had here, but we'll get additionally correct. A bit of a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I believe Community and Regional Affairs did work on something like that last year, and so they might have something.
This would be a follow-up. Please continue.
Section 7 is strictly a technical change because the item in regards to the residents 65 years or older are addressed in Section 6. Therefore, that's deleted from Section 7. Section 8, 9, and 10, all three of those address the fact that if a spouse marries a minor, somebody under the age of 18 years of age, that spouse can sign for the minor to obtain the driver's license and accept the financial responsibility of the minor. The reason for that, generally, when a minor gets married, the parents no longer want to accept the financial responsibility.
Senator Kelly.
Can I revert back to Section 7 for a second?
Yes.
Line 14, special request place $20. Is that the vanity claim? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is. This is not changing that. That is what it is. Okay.
How many special license plates do they have?
I am not sure on that. I'm not sure. I think it's a little over 2,000.
$20, does that even pay for the cost of production of the plate?
Mr. Chairman, basically the plate itself costs us $4.50 for the set of plates. And then there's the additional handling process. Of course, they have to apply on a separate form. We have to order the plates separately. And the rest of it goes towards the special handling. And that is a one-time charge. It's only when they first apply for that plate. If they come back the next year to renew the plate, they pay the regular $30 per passenger car.
Maybe an additional source of revenue that I can see the members of the Finance Committee.
Maybe get finders.
$43.
Would it break my heart?
Senator Kelly, the state of California charges a great deal more than this. Is that correct?
In Florida, I believe it's $50.
I believe California is $50 also. That's my recollection.
Did this go to Finance?
Speaks to the spouse signer for a minor. Section 11 clarifies the point that the court and the department gives the court and the department the right to take away non-resident driving privileges as well as resident driving privileges for the same reasons, such as for a DWI, uninsured accident, and so forth. Strictly a technical change. Section 12, this is now addressed in our regulations, Department of Law, and recommended we also address it in statute. What it is the warning letter that we mail out when somebody's halfway to the point total where we would suspend their license, that warning letter go out on first-class mail rather than certified or registered mail. This notice is not something that takes away their privilege. It's just warning them that if they continue to accumulate points, that the driving privileges will be taken away. Last year, the difference was almost $22,000 between a first-class letter and a certified letter. 13 is, again, strictly a technical change. It now words if a person's arrested while operating a car, and changes it for operating while intoxicated.
Let me revert to, back to the section 1 with regard to vehicle impoundment. There is no fiscal note on the bill, yet the state will be responsible for towing impounded vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, basically, if it's impounded by the state, that is true, the trooper could pay for it. If it's impounded by the municipality would pay for it. This is operation at this time. They do impound a vehicle if it's defaced, if the VIN number is defaced. And any time that the vehicle is impounded and the owner cannot get it back right away, if there's a hold on it until investigation is being processed, the agency that impounded it does have to pay for it. That's the same as on a homicide. If the vehicle is being held for a homicide investigation, and the investigating agency will not release it to the owner, the investigating agency has to pay for that cost. So this procedure is being done at this time. This is just strictly to give them explicit authority. There should be no increase in cost as a result of this being done.
Are I don't wish to belabor the point. I raised it before. We're all trying to find ways to ensure that the budget goes on. Again, a question of who should pay for the impounding. We're not going to pass the bill out today, but the committee will reflect on that. In the meantime, I would like to make several changes. Pass it out in a week. So, Senator Bakes?
Mr. Chairman, would you mind, as Judiciary Chairman, if we had the exact number of vanity plates known and what the increase would be if we changed it to $50?
Could you provide us with that information? The number of plates and the possible additional revenue, that's a properly financed question, the robust with finance. And perhaps by the time it gets there, then they will have the information and the
sure,
time
we'll
to go arrive.
With our Anchorage office and see if that's available. It should be.
I appreciate that very much. If you could direct that, I'll copy both through myself and Senator Bakes.
Okay.
She's a finance co-chair. Are there any other comments by
money?
Senator, may I have just a moment for some policy direction on something? If this bill comes up again, I may try to put an amendment on it to a recent court decision came out saying that the car's parking lot is not a vehicular way. So, for example, if someone gets stopped for DWLS, driving while license suspended, that he cannot, he was not on a vehicular way, and therefore that conviction would not hold. And I was going to try to put some language together for today, but I couldn't figure it out in time. Is that something that is philosophically any problem with that? I mean, the fact that it is private property, and if I can get by the legal problems at all, cars parking lot versus a highway?
I can't speak for the rest of the committee, but I can only speak for myself. I think it's important because of the large number of shopping centers we have in my constituency. The public deserves the same protection there that they have on a vehicular way. So does any member of the community object to that point of view?
Makes private property used for public purposes is what we're talking about.
Yes, it's no legal doctrine that certainly nothing new.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, if I could ask through you to the assistant AG, if a person is intoxicated in a parking lot, drives the car into a parked car in the parking lot, what do they get charged with?
For driving while intoxicated, you can get charged anywhere. I mean, there's no restriction on highway or vehicular way or anything like that. You can be driving your tractor in a barley field and you can be charged with DWI.
Okay.
It's only for driving while license suspended, financial responsibility, insurance, things like that, where they have the restriction on vehicular way or highway.
Okay. I feel better.
Senator Kelly.
For the possible amendment, if I wanted to allow National Guardsmen to buy their own plate, send National Guard on it, and a number, where would I put that in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, basically the division opposes specialized plates because of all the extra handling, but there's
special request plate, right?
It looks a bit, there's soon to be the DLW plates.
Where did we add the DLW plates?
They're in here on line 20, page 5. This says for no cost. Any vehicle.
Remember we passed the, I've seen one.
I know there's a case for that.
Would it be acceptable to fill out the amendment?
election. Are there any other comments from members of the committee or from those persons who testified? If there's not, this bill also will lay on the table. We will take it up within a week with those suggestions from the Attorney General's office, as well as the deletions from the present bill before us, some possible language added for the senior citizen exemption, an existing problem, and then also a possible change after we confer with the court system and again with the Assistant Attorney General. Yes?
Is there any problem conceptually with the
national I've reserved judgment on that at this point. I might
have to go.
But we thank you for your courtesy, Senator Kelly. If there's no other business to come before us, the Judiciary Committee is adjourned.